And welcome again, good afternoon, to another edition of Social Gaming and Computing, Social something. last time we finished our considerations on social signal processing, and that spans the whole range from long-term social context to a short-term social context, and all the various ways to model that and to algorithmically detect those contexts, instantiate them, describe them. And, that's that. So we're left with one more topic in the lecture, and that topic is actually game theory, right? Now you can say, game theory, isn't that supposed to be only for the games engineering students? No, obviously not. It's rather, of lesser significance, but maybe it's part of the general education that even a games engineering or a practical games engineering student would be interested in, perhaps. And, that's that. So from an organizational point of view, what we're going to do is we're going to have a lecture today and tomorrow, and perhaps, depending on how we get along, also next Tuesday, but then we're through, right? And then that's that. Okay. So everybody can prepare for the exam. So for the games engineering students, there is one more thing coming up, and that's the final presentations. So the scheduled, the planned date was the 8th of July. And I think that we're going to do it that half of the groups is going to present on the 7th, all in these regular lecture dates, so to be sure that everybody is available. And the other half of the groups is then due to present the stuff Wednesdays, right? But I'm going to announce this on Piazza properly. But for the social computing students, I think it was that. So as for the exercise, we're seeing that everybody that, had the courage to do it until the end is already perhaps through with that. So I think we're currently in the stage of working on the last assignment there, right? And so that should do the trick for the for all of those that did the exercise. And Christoph and I will announce the results on the actual website, right? So everybody can access his or her personal account via his or her password, and then can see what the results were. And again, we're trying to be very generous in that regard. And then, the exam is on the 3rd of August, and then we're through, right? So why game theory? Game theory is about the structured interaction between agents. An agent can be almost any entity that socially intelligently interacts. And we've seen the definition on, the previous slide said what socially intelligent action might be defined as. So that includes algorithms, robots, humans, any entity that is able to interact with other entities in a structured fashion. And, that's a typical part of, distributed AI, but also a typical ingredient in theoretical economics, right? So any of you that had anything to do with economics so far will, in one way or the other, have gotten into contact with game theory, right? So game theory formalizes these interactions, and we will see that it does so via utility functions, right? And utility functions also play a role actually in true games, because as we have seen in our first lecture, that games are often about competition and very often about winning. And so that's what this thing has gotten its name from, game theory. But we will see it's more a formal mathematical theory, but one that well, has its impact throughout of social computing and social gaming, right? And you can broaden these concepts by playing the games on actual networks, right? And this is what we all do in our daily endeavors. Practically all of our things that we do, may it be acting economically by trading or buying or selling whatever, or by just acting socially, can be, well, in a lossy way, but it can be modeled by games, right? So every interaction can be modeled by the question, what do I have to gain from that interaction? What does the other one have to gain from it, right? And this can be broken down to almost all areas of social interaction, at least from a modeling perspective. I'm not saying that all of culture and all of these things should be described in terms of game theory, but for the moment, let's assume that, right? So that's a formal way to describe interactions, and thus it has its natural place in such a lecture, right? Good. Now, the basic scenarios is that there are these actors, these agents, whatever nature they are of, and we'll call them players, okay? And the basic scenario is that they simultaneously choose some action to do, and the result of all the actions that all the players that are taking part in the game select together decide what is the outcome in some state space, okay? So, for example, if I approach another human, and I hit him in the face, and the other one hits me in the face, then we start brawling, and one of them gets knocked out. Well, that's a certain outcome in the possible state space. I can choose another action. I can hug him, and, don't know what else, and then maybe he hits me in the face, and then I get knocked out, and that's a different outcome, right? And the thing is that the outcome always depends on the combination of all the players' actions, okay? And for the moment to explain that, we would just assume that we're dealing with a two-state action space. So each of the players has the chance to C, cooperate, or D, to defect, right? So these are just abstract actions, okay? And the outcome is determined by something that may be called a state transformer function. So it's working or happening on the combination of all the players' actions and determines an outcome state in some abstract state space. By the way, as always, we're having a background reading for this part, and the background reading for game theory is twofold, right? So the first part that we are mainly going to do today is taken out of Michael Wooldridge's Multi-Agent Systems book, and I put this online, the relevant chapters, I put them online on Piazza. And the second part is taken by Fudenberg and Tyrol's Game Theory book, which is one of the game theory classics. And I think both of them have been at least nominated for the Nobel Prize in Economics, so they're the real knowledgeable guys, and you'll see that the information density of the book is really extremely high, right? And we're only going to cover a few pages, right? And the book has, I don't know, about 500 or so, right? So two parts, and the first part taken out of Michael Wooldridge's book, right? Good. Back to the actual stuff. So that is what we are going to deal with. And well, there can be a few different cases, right? So it can be the case that the outcome is only dependent on one player's actions. Like in the first example, we see that, in the last example, where the outcome is only dependent on what the second player does, okay? No matter what the first player does, the outcome is only dependent on the second player. And in the first case where we get four different states for all the four combinations of this assume 2x2 interaction, two-player interaction, then we get an environment which is sensitive to both players' actions, right? And it can be also the case that no player has any influence on the actual state, and that is the second example, right? So we'll always get the second, we'll always get a constant state no matter what the players do. So one example for this middle case could be like the course of the sun is completely independent of whatever I do, right? If I choose to, let's say, hit one of you or take out my purse and throw away the money, no matter what I do, the sun will always go down in the west and start in the east. So there is nothing I can do, right? And there's nothing you can do either. And the one example for this, where the environment is only controlled by one player, is maybe parts of the current Greek financial crisis, right? So there might be settings where no matter what Merkel does, Tsipras will do this and this and this. But the whole Greek crisis is a typical example for game theory, because what is the outcome is dependent on both players' actions, right? And that's why this is interesting in economy, right? So you have sellers, buyers, auctions, you have certain monopolies, and all these things have their influence in what comes out. Good. Now, what we see is that these outcomes should have a certain valuation for each player, right? And that is formalized through utility functions. So each player has a unique utility function that maps the states of the state space to a scalar utility value. Right, and this could be an example. If we're having four environmental states, these could be the utilities of the first player, and this row would be the assigned utilities of the second player, right? And thus we can shortcut the state space at all and just say the respective actions directly map to utilities. And that's what we will have in almost all the cases, right? Now, interesting in game theory is that not all the respective utilities are the same. If they would be, then we would just have no preference. But in all interactions, in all regular formalized interactions, we do have a preferred outcome. So if I'm trading, or if I'm going into business with someone, then my preferred state is the one where I have the most money, right? Or when I try to win someone's friendship, the outcome where I actually succeed in doing so is worth more to me than any other one, right? So there is a preference relation, which means that since we're having a direct mapping from the action spaces and the conjoint action spaces to the utilities, we're having a preference relation. So since for the first player, for player I, we see that CC is, as well as CD, strictly preferred to DC or DD. That is the outcome of these, to be more precise. We have these larger or equal preferences, these weak preferences, or these strict preferences, which are easy to see from the respective numerical values, right? And what we can also see is that for game theory, it doesn't matter very much whether we have a 4 here or a 3 here, right? So it can actually make a difference, right? So it's not true that the preference for the whole, or the treatment of the game is invariant with respect to downsizing the utilities, but for the preference relation, it's obviously not relevant whether we have a numerical value of 4, 25, or 170, right? And well, obviously, having these preference relations for player I, the action C is something that we call the rational choice, right? Because all the outcomes that result from me as player I playing C are strictly referred by me compared to those where I play D, right? No matter what the other does, okay? And C is also the rational choice for J because these two C's correspond to strategies which we strictly prefer as player J compared to those where we play D. Okay. Now, this is why we call C the rational choice for I and J at the same time, right? And the usual way to write this down is the game matrix or payoff matrix, right? And we see that both players have their respective dimensions in the matrix. So player I has the columns and player J has the rows. And we see that we can write down the respective utility values in such a matrix. And that's exactly equal to stating these things as in such a textual form. Okay? And we call player I the column player and player J the role player. Okay? And this is not restricted to a 2x2 interaction. It can also be that the respective strategy options for each player are more than two. So we could have a 5x5 matrix, right? So this would mean that we still have two players, but each of them has five actions. It can also be a rectangular matrix. So for example, like a 2x5 matrix, which means that one player has five choices of actions and the other one has only two. Right. It can also be like a 3x3x3 tensor or a 3x3x3x5x15x125. So there's any combination that is allowed. These would correspond to a higher number of players. Okay. Good. Now the question is, in those settings, what should I do? And that's the only question. Okay, the only question that we will be concerned with is basically, what should I do? And we say that a set of outcome states, which directly or should more or less directly be mapped to the actual actions that lead to them. It may be the case that some different actions or action combinations map to the same state. So that's why the formulation is in terms of state, states. So one set of states weakly dominates another set of states for a given player. If any outcome in this state omega one is preferable or at least as good as every state in the second set. So that means that for all these actions in, or no, these are not actions, for all these states in the first set, there should be a weak preference of these states in omega 1 to omega 2. And we'd have a notion for weak dominance, we also have a notion for strong dominance, which means, or strong domination, and the only thing that we replace is this larger or equal, this stylized larger or equal preference to this strict preference, okay? And if the preference relation on the outcome states is, for example, such as denoted here, then we can say that, for example, the set of these two states is strongly preferred by player one, or this set is said to be strongly dominating the other set for this player, right? So we always have this with respect to the preference of one player, right? And that's the interesting thing, because all the players might have different preferences. If all had the same, then things would be comparatively easy, right? Now, in game theory, those actions that lead to states are called strategies, right? So what I do is I, as a player, I choose one of the actions, or as we will see in the second part, I can also choose a stochastic mixture of actions. But for the moment, let's assume we're only choosing pure actions, one of them. And good. So S star is then the set of possible states that result from playing the strategy S. And, well, playing a strategy means that each player simultaneously chooses one action, and the result is this strategy small s, right? So small s is a vector. So if we have two players, then small s would be a vector of two actions, the action taken by the first player as the first component and the action taken by the second player as the second component, okay? And, well, having this state transformer function, we can have from player I's point of view, this notation, right? So the set of possible outcomes from playing D is omega 1, omega 2, and the set of outcomes of playing C is this, right? And thus, we can transfer our notation of strict dominance or strict domination to strategies, right? So we say that a strategy strongly or weakly dominates another if the respective outcome state set does so with respect to the respective outcome state set, right? And obviously, if for me as a player one strategy strictly dominates another one, it is or should be easy to see what to do, right? Because I would like to have the one that gives the higher output, okay? And thus, it, as we will see, there is a way to decide upon what to do, and that's called iterated strict dominance. And this works by deleting those strategies that are actually dominated, because that's of no utility, right? And if I say, well, a strategy is a vector, well, that's a bit of a confusing use of wording, right? So if S is the vector where I have the action taken by player one and the action taken by player two, this all is called a strategy profile, to be more precise, and these things are the strategies of the respective players, or the actions, right? So this is, and we'll repeat this notation later in the second part, right? The first part is more to get a bit into the game. Now, one central notion in game theory is the notion of Nash equilibrium, and some of you might have seen the famous Hollywood movie that dealt with the fate of John Nash, right? And he obviously was extremely brilliant, but suffered from some mental diseases and thus wasn't able to constantly work on his research. However, he designed these very important contributions to game theory. And one of the central notions is the notion of Nash equilibrium, right? And this is in close connection to the question of what I should do, right? And the unfortunate thing is what I should do is dependent on what the others do. And what the others do is also dependent on what I do, right? And this is like a recursive definition. And as with all recursive definitions, there might be something like a fixed point where it is clear for everybody what to do. And this is a Nash equilibrium, because in a Nash equilibrium, it is the case that assuming that player I plays the strategy as one, player J can do no better than play some other strategy as two. At the same time, it's also true that assuming that player J plays as two, player I can also do no better than play as one. So S1, S2 is a Nash equilibrium because no one has an incentive to deviate, right? Because I cannot win anything. So if I'm player one, assuming that the other one will play S2, well, I can do no better than play S1. And if I'm player two, assuming that my other player competitor plays S1, I can do no better than play S2. Right? And that's the central notion. And, well, basically in Fudenberg and Tyrol's book, there is four large parts. And each part corresponds to one situation, right? So the first situation is that we know the complete matrix and we only play once, right? And these things are called static games because I only play once of complete information, okay? Now, it can be the case, and the thing is that in these things, we assume that all the players have full mutual knowledge about this matrix, right? So if I interact with someone that tries to sell me something, I know that the seller of a good wants to make profit, right? So I know his incentives, I know his utilities, and I know mine, and he knows that I know that he knows, and we know everything, right? This is common knowledge, this matrix. Now, if some of these entries are unknown, then we're dealing with games of incomplete information, and you might already have an intuition. What we would then do is at the same, basically the same as with latent variables in machine learning, we have to sum them out, right? Probabilistically. So we have to compute some form of expected value, right? So if I don't know what the other one is up to, right? When I hit him, right? I don't know what his utilities are, right? And I don't know how strong he would react, then I would have to do an expectation, right? I count the number of tattoos. I count the evilness of his gaze. And then I do some expectation, some things about his utility. That might be the case, right? And this is another thing that we're not going to talk about. Third family is games of complete information, which are played multiple times. Because if a game is played multiple times, we will see here that things drastically change. So what's a good strategy in a one-shot game might not necessarily be a good strategy if I play things repeatedly, right? And then the most advanced form is dynamic games of incomplete information, right? So this is then I would have to use different forms of computation, right? Now, all of these four families have their own notation of Nash equilibrium, right? And each one is a refinement or a more complicated version of the next, right? And this is the most basic form that we have here, and we will get a more mathematical formulation later on, okay? Now, things would always be very nice what to do would be easy if any such game had a pure strategy Nash equilibrium, but this is not the case, right? There are games that have no or even multiple pure strategy Nash equilibrium. What is true, however, is that each such game, such simple game, has a mixed Nash equilibrium, and we will see what this is later on. Right? So if there is no pure strategy equilibrium, or if there are more than one, it's not so clear what to do, right? And we will see examples where we would have one strict Nash equilibrium, and in this case, it's very easy, right? Good. Some more notations. So we might call a scenario or a game strictly competitive if a player prefers some outcome over another if the other player just has the opposite preference relations, right? So winning and losing. If I win, the other one loses, right? And if the sum of utilities is exactly zero, so if the amount by which I value my win is the same amount by which the other one values his or her loss, then we call this a zero-sum game, right? And of course, zero-sum games are always strictly competitive, but the other direction might not be true, or is not true. And obviously, what the one wins, the other one loses in a zero-sum game. Now, strictly zero-sum games like chess or other artificial games, or are only such artificial games are really strictly zero-sum. So in most real-world interactions, there is something, well, that the loss of the loser might not hurt as bad as the win of the winner. And this is an interesting thing because it allows us, especially under the assumption that we will multiple times play a game, right, to kind of deviate in real life from the strategy that we need to win anytime, right? Because it can be a good strategy to locally deviate and say, well, for the moment I lost, but doesn't hurt so much, right? And this also has to do with repeated games, because as I said, I can expect to repeatedly play this game again, okay? Good. But unfortunately, many encounters are actually perceived as zero-sum games, right? And that's why brawls between men actually occur, because if one backs off while the other one gives him a hit, right, then actually the only thing that I take is a swollen face, and then I can go home unhurt, right? But if I hit him back, then he might fall down and be dead, right? Depends, or I might be dead. Depends on who's the better kickboxer. I don't know. It's this perception which is completely ruled out here, because in game theory we are not talking about perception and psychology so much, but more about actual logics and mathematics. Okay, good. Now, one of the most famous games is actually the Prisoner's Dilemma. Who has already heard about the Prisoner's Dilemma? Who has not heard about the Prisoner's Dilemma? Okay, good. So most of you will know this. And the story is as such. Two criminals are held in separate cells, right? So we catch two suspects, and we don't allow them to communicate. And later on, they will be sentenced to some jail sentence. And if the situation is that one confesses, right, and the other one does not, the one that confesses is taken as a crown witness, right? So the confessor is freed, and the other one gets the most severe punishment, because the authorities then know from the crown witness that actually the other one actually committed the severe crime. If both confess, then no one can really act as the crown witness, but they get a mild sentence nevertheless. Let's say they both get 2 years, and in the first case, the one that did not confess gets 3. And if neither confesses, if they just keep their mouth shut, the proof might not be enough to confess, to condemn them, so they get something like 1 year, right? Now, we have the following notations or associations. So confessing to the authorities means defecting to the other comrade criminal, right? So to betray the other comrade criminal. Because usually criminals would agree on some Yakuza, Mafia, Omerta style of agreement, never say anything to the authorities. And to not confess would be to cooperate in the sense of that the two criminals cooperate among each other, right? And if we translate these prison sentences to utility values, then we might get a matrix like this, right? So both cooperate with one another, That corresponds to situation number three. Neither confesses, so both get 1 year, so the utility is somehow high. But not as high as in the case where the first player defects, so J defects, and if he defecting means he confesses to the authorities, he's a crown witness, and thus he's freed, he gets the highest utility, and the other one gets the maximum sentence of 3 years. So the other one is the betrayed one. He cooperated or she cooperated, but the other one defected. So the cooperating one that follows the omertave gets a utility of zero, right? Whereas both confess, each one gets 2 years, right? And this is lower than if both defect. Sorry, if both do not confess, if they cooperate, right? So this is DD, this is CC, and these are the symmetric mixed situations, okay? Now the question would be, if you were one of the prisoners, what would you do, right? So let's take one of those that do not yet know the solution, right? What would you do? Do you have a guess? So maybe you were the one that showed up. You didn't know it. Yeah. What would you do? Okay, why? Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right, right? So the thing is obviously not as difficult, right? So the Nash equilibrium is actually to confess, that mean defect, okay? So DD is the Nash equilibrium, okay? And well, this is another term. In this case, this is called the sucker's payoff, right? Good. And well, again, the situation, these are the resulting preference relations, and these are the outcomes. So this is something we already know. And now what is the one possible course of reasoning, maybe very similar to what you said, right? So if I'm some player, if I cooperate, I have two possibilities. If the other one also cooperates, we'll get three. And if the other one defects, I get the sucker's payoff. So the best guaranteed payoff when I cooperate is zero. And that's, well, all I can say. I don't know what the other one does, and the best guaranteed is zero, right? If I defect and do the same reasoning, the best guaranteed payoff is two. So I do not know how the other one would actually act. So what I do is I'll defect, because then I get a minimum guaranteed payoff of two, whereas in the other case, the minimum guaranteed payoff is zero. Now, DD actually is the Nash equilibrium. Okay? Good. Now, why don't both take C? Because if they play CC, then the utility for each of the players would be one higher than in the Nash equilibrium. Okay? They would both get three instead of two. So why don't they play C? Well, the answer is because if I play C according to this rationale, the other one will play D, okay? Because if I play C and the other one plays D, he would get five and I would get zero, right? And assuming that the other one plays D, I would surely also choose to play D, because then I get at least two and not zero. So if we remember the definition of Nash equilibrium, assuming that the other player plays something, I can do no better than play this. Right? So CC is obviously not a Nash equilibrium, because assuming that the other one cooperates, I can do better than cooperating, namely by defecting, because then I get five instead of three. So CC cannot be a Nash equilibrium. Okay? And well, that's the story in the world. Be an asshole. Okay? Good. And this Well, this is also true, for example, for things such as nuclear arms reduction and stuff like this, right? But why would the Russians and the U.S. Americans nevertheless sign the treaties that say, well, we'll reduce our arms? Well, the answer is because, again, as you suspected, they repeatedly play in different fields. And that is one game is even related to other games, because there is this arms muscle type of game, and there is the economy type of well-being game, and these are all related, right? And that's the motivation to deviate from the Nash equilibrium. And in order to be able to do that, the true game would have lots more states, actually. So one moral is don't oversimplify when modeling, because you might get the wrong Nash equilibrium, right? And, well, we can ask ourselves, is Machiavellism really the answer, right? The question then goes on and says, well, is there something like true altruism, or is the form of altruism we see in the world just a form of, well, Nash equilibrium or rational choice? So am I being nice to my husband only because I want something from him, or am I being nice to, of course, the lady's not, or am I being nice because of love or something? Yeah. And that is, well, interesting question. I won't go into that, obviously. As we will see that this, well, even if there were not something as unconditional altruism, right? Even if something doesn't exist, there is one way out of Machiavellism, and that's strict rationalism as we employ it here in game theory is often only employed when the sucker's payoff really hurts, right? If the loser's payoff is not that bad, I might opt in favor of, well, some other strategy, actually. I give the beggar 2 euros, although I might never see him again, because psychologically, and that's this, again, this strict rationalism, well, transformed, I expect, well, social security. So I contribute to some background socialness, right? And then I can later on, because I think that I can then later on appeal to this other people's socialness when I'm the beggar, right? But this is more psychology and not about game theory. So your argumentation was more formal and more intelligent than that, or more, well, mathematical, because the situation is different if I play multiple such games, because there is something that we might call the shadow of the future, right? So if I betray the other one, and I constantly do so, I will never be able to expect any mercy from this other person, right? And if I start with cooperation and the other one also thinks, well, shadow of the future, we might be better off in those multiple sequential games, right? Good. And if we do so and assume that we can, each player can see all past actions of the other player, there might be a different reasoning, okay? Because the reasoning might go as such. So if I defect, the other one might punish me, right? Because we're, as you said, we're not having a one-shot PD game. And if I test for cooperation and the other one hits me, I might test one more time and he hits me again, then I continue hitting him all the time, right? But testing for cooperation is not as expensive in this case, because if I play 100 times, then this loss of 2 possible utility points is not such a severe accident, right? So because of that, in an iterated prisoner's dilemma game, cooperation is actually the rational choice, right? And now we see that things are completely changed from DD to CC just because of repeatedly playing. Now there is one drawback in this. This cooperation is rational, it's only valid if I play an infinite number of times. Why? If I play a finite number of times, what will happen in the last game? So in the last game, there is no shadow of the future, no possibility to retaliate, okay? Which means that in the last game, obviously, DD becomes the rational choice, right? So the last game is already done, and both will be assholes in the last game, right? Now, the only true game is the second to last game, right? But then, the second to last game, if that's the only true game, yeah, both will be assholes again, right? And then, rolling from back to forth, we will see that if you apply the same argument recursively, you'll end up at all D as the rational choice again. However, fortunately, as you might have already read on the slide, most games are of a structure, or most real life games, that you don't know about the precise number of interactions, right? So there's this saying, so you always meet twice, right? Which means that I cannot be sure how many interactions I will have with the other player. And that, again, makes it rational to come up with CC again, right? Good. Well, that made people think of, obviously, CC is the rational choice, but can't we just try out some repeated strategies? And in 1980, so back in the ancient times, long before your birth, there was this researcher, Axelrod, and he called for other researchers to submit computer programs that would implement a certain strategy. Right? And they send in all kinds of those strategies. For example, one was all D, always defect, right? Because there is rational arguments for that, as we saw. Then there was random, there was tit for tat. So on the first round, do cooperate and then just mercilessly retaliate what was ever done by the other, right? Tester was a strategy that was intended to exploit other nice programs. And so on the first round, I would test the opponent with defect. If the opponent would retaliate, then I play tit for tat because I see, well, you're not so weak. So, okay, I acknowledge, well, you're not a dumbass. So I would, well, at least do what you do. And if the opponent does cooperate, I would cooperate, and then defect, right? And the idea was to earn these five winners points from the occasional defect. Something like this, right? And there was others, like deviating from CCD by replacing some C randomly with a D and so on. Now, what would you think was the overall winning strategy? So what they did was they let each agent play against all others, and then the total utility was recorded, right? So what was the winning strategy? Any guess? The ladies. Tit for tat, why? Yes. Okay, so the reasoning was tit for tat because it starts with cooperating, and if the other one would play tit for tat like strategies, they would also cooperate. But then I would only get 3-3-3 all the time, but I will never earn the 5, right? Okay. Is there other opinions? Always defect. Why? Yeah. Yes, but you would always win. But that doesn't mean that you maximize in a certain sense, right? Because there is three at stake, and that would be her reasoning, right? And there is five at stake that maybe would have won by tester-like strategies, right? So Ald is also not a wise choice. Actually, what happened is that tit for tat actually won the tournament, yes? And, well, because on average against all the other strategies, it was the best strategy. If you just sum up the utilities, naturally, tit for tat is defeated by Ald, right? But at the cost that the Ald agent just earns two all the time, right? If the other one also defects, right? And it may be the case that it somehow sometimes earns the five, yeah, if the other one cooperates. But obviously it turned out that overall tit for tat was the winner. This is just an experiment, right? I think that does not possess any true game theoretic formal mathematical truth. Yeah, it was just trying out, right? So that's why Axelrod came up in his analysis with some rules. And the rules were don't be envious, right? So it's not necessary to beat your opponent to actually do well. This would be like this ultra-aggressive type of behavior. Second thing, don't be the first to defect because you can expect the other one to retaliate, right? So be nice in the beginning, yeah? And do a reciprocation of C and D, right? So don't be a fool. So balance being aggressive and forgiving and encourage the cooperation, right? And be fair. And don't be too clever, right? So there were strategies that kind of had some elaborate logic built in. But since in game theory, everything depends on all the actions of all the players, it's sometimes good to be not too clever because you just cannot assume to be able to look in the other people's heads in real life, right? It can, if you know the whole matrix and you know that there is a Nash equilibrium, then you can really look into other people's head because they all behave in a rational way. That's why the Nash equilibrium is the answer. But in those, yeah, rather fluffy situations, it may be good to not be too clever, right? Okay, right. And some of the programs had a complex opponent model, but, these strategies were not successful in the game, and there are several reasons. So if there's a very complex model that does not do any learning, then it's almost the same as random, right? The second thing, when the other defects, some of the programs were not forgiving enough, right? So they would just retaliate because they assumed too much evil in the other one. And, if I employ learning, then in the course of the tournament, this didn't play such a great role because the strategies were so different. Now, that's different from real life because on average, I learn as a child and I constantly learn that it's very probable when I hit other people that they're going to be hitting back. And if I hug them, then the probability is that most of the people will also be nice to me, right? And on average, these things are true. That's why we based all of our considerations with respect to long-term and short-term social context on the fact that, social behavior is something that is a sort of a fixed point in society, right? We have converged to something that we might envision as a large Nash equilibrium, right? With certain local perturbations, right? Good. So, the question is there other games? Of course, there's other games. And if we restrict ourselves to these 2x2 games, that means two players with two actions each, there is for faculty many such games, because in essence the only definite thing, the only thing that matters is the preference relation and not the absolute numerical values, right? And if I have these, the first line, I have the prisoner's dilemma, right? And there is other ones like the game of chicken and the stag hunt that we will be investigating in a second. And then there is these even more simple situation where defection just dominates or cooperation just denominates, right? Dominates. And why are they called symmetric? Well, this is the symmetry axis with respect to the preference relations, right? And there are, as I said, 24 such games. Now let's look at those, and especially those two. So the stag hunt, right? So the original story by Jean-Jacques Rousseau from the 18th century was that two people go for a hunt, and they can decide which type of animal they will hunt. And if both go for hares, for small animals, they would both succeed individually. They would get some medium payoff, let's say, right? If one goes for the stag, for the large animal, and the other one decides to go for a hare only, the hare guy will win the hare, because that's something he can manage alone, but the stag can only be successfully hunted if both cooperate, right? If both cooperate and they really catch the stag, then they would get the highest payoff, right? If both go for the hare, that is both defect, then they would both catch the hare, but will get a substantially lower payoff. And if one goes for the hare and the other one goes for the stag, then the one with the hare not only has the hare, but also the triumph of the other one not getting anything. Let's say this is the story, right? And so this is the preference relation, and this is one possible payoff matrix, right? And you can think of any modern variant you like, right? It turns out that this thing has two pure Nash equilibria, right? And that is DD and CC, right? Let's check. So why is CC a pure Nash equilibrium? Well, if I assume that the other one will also hunt the stag, then I can do no better than also hunt the stag. And if I assume that the other one hunts the hare, I can actually do no better than also hunt the hare. Okay? This is actually the case, right? Okay, yeah, that's true. Okay, so CC and DD are two Nash equilibria. Now, this is an unfortunate situation because, well, asking the question, what should I do, is simply unclear. Should I go for the stag or should I go for the hare? Well, I don't know, okay, because there are two Nash equilibria in this case. Now, other thing is this game of chicken with this preference relation, and this is a possible realization. And the typical variant is two protagonists drive at a very narrow road or a bridge, and you can have two actions, steer away or not steer away. Okay, so if both defect, that means both don't steer away, the result would be bam, yeah, and they would both die, right? If both steer away, they would be both chicken, right? But at least they would survive, right? And if one's a chicken and the other one's the, well, narrow-minded, I will never steer away type of guy, then obviously, the one that steers away would get the loser's payoff in that regard, because the other one would be the hero, and the hero gets the most rewards, right? Again, if I assume that the other one will steer away, I can do no better than stay straight, because then I'll be the hero and he'll be the chicken, right? And just the symmetric version. So again, we have two Nash equilibria, and well, it's unclear what to do, which makes this game a bit more interesting, because we have the BAM as one possible outcome. Okay, good. So that's this. And we'll investigate the actual situation in more depth now, right? Because part B is taken out of the book by Frudenberg and Tyrol, which is a bit more complicated and more mathematically rigorous. So that's all the stuff from Michael Wooldridge's book, just to get into the mood of game theory. And now we'll be more formal with respect to that. So first of all, we need some more precise notation. Okay, good, as always. Now, let's assume we're having this matrix here as an example. So this is a 2x2 player, a two-player interaction, a two-player game, and each of those players has three possible actions or three possible pure strategies. Left, middle, and right for the column player, and up, middle, and down for the row player, right? And each one has its respective utilities. And now the utilities are written in this more simple fashion. So the first corresponds to the first index of the matrix, and the second utility corresponds to the second index of the matrix. So more mathematical. Okay. Now the set of players is, well, denoted by some index, and there are large I many players. So in this case, large I is equal to 2. And well, we're having player with index 1 and the other one, the blue player's player with index 2. Now, the pure strategy space of one player is just the actions that are at hand of the respective player. So UMD is the strategy space for player 1 and LMR for the second player. And as we said before, a strategy profile S is a vector of such actions, where the first action is taken by the first player, the second by the second player, and the large ith action is taken by the large ith player, right? So for example, in this situation with two players, DM might be such a strategy profile, right? So an outcome of the game where the players simultaneously choose. And if we take the product of all these strategy spaces, we'll get the large finite space of strategy profiles. And in this case, we have 9 such possibilities, of course, right? And then we again have this payoff function for the respective player, right? So for example, the payoff function for player 1 applied to the strategy profile UL would give a 4, right? UL is the strategy profile played, and the first player gets a 4, and the second player gets a 3, right? And so on and so on. And what's a very convenient notation is that if I'm regarding some player I, and I'm regarding all the others as a unified mass for the moment, then I's opponents are denoted as minus I, right? So minus I is the set of indices of all the other players, right? In this case, minus 1 is 2, okay? Now, in a zero-sum game, again, I have that the sum of all the utilities is actually 0. We have common knowledge. All the players know that all the players know, and blah, blah, blah. And that's so far only what we know up to the present point. Now, there is one interesting thing that gets into the discussion now, and that's so-called mixed strategies, right? And mixed strategies are nothing but a randomization, right? Instead of choosing one such action definitely and all the others not, what I do is I assign a discrete probability distribution to all my actions that are available to me, okay? So what I do, and this probability distribution maps each such action, such strategy that is available to me to a probability value. So for example, if I'm the first player, my possible strategies are U, M, and D. And I might say I play U with a probability of 1/3, M with a probability of 2/3, and D I will never play. Right? So that's a randomization. And this is interesting because we will see that, for example, each such well-behaved game will actually have a mixed strategy Nash equilibrium, yeah, or a mixed Nash equilibrium then, right? And we will get a more precise definition for that, right? So thus, sigma I of Si is the probability that player I assigns to strategy Si, or the probability that player I will play Si, right? Which is basically the same for us because we're having one shot again and I'm playing with a certain probability. And we will see that this actually is very clever because, for example, in the work or shark game that we will investigate, it plays a decisive role whether I play something with certainty or whether the other one must assume that I kind of randomize. And this is about the employer controlling the employee, because we will see that if the employer controls the employee all the time, then this will be a great nuisance for the employee and also a waste of actual working time for the employer. So what he will do, he will say, well, I will control you, but you don't know when and how often, right? And we will see that corresponding to the utilities, it's the same if you park somewhere. If you're looking for a parking lot in Schwabing, what you consider is there might be a polytest checking whether I park there with a certain probability, and given all the utilities, I will or will not park there, right? So this is all, yeah, assuming randomization, okay? And the policeman will also check for these parking violations with a certain probability. If they never do, anyone would park as he or she wished. If they would always do, then they wouldn't be able to catch any real criminals, right? Good. Now, in rock, paper, scissors, right, what's a Nash equilibrium? As we will see, this game matrix encodes what will win against what, right? So paper will win against rock, and rock will win against scissors. So the stuff you know, right? And this will is encoded in this matrix. And we will see that there is no pure Nash equilibrium. If there were a pure Nash equilibrium, then, or at least if there were one, this wouldn't be a nice game because it would be clear what to do. But there is a mixed Nash equilibrium because if each fully randomizes, right, the other one can do no better than also fully randomizing. Because if the other one would choose a definite thing, he would have less profit than if he would also completely randomize. Thus, we have a so-called mixed Nash equilibrium with full randomization. Good. More notation. The space of mixed strategies is this large sigma I, and the space of mixed strategy profiles is the product of all the single players' mixed strategy spaces, right? And in contrast to a pure strategy profile, which is each player just choosing one pure action, a mixed strategy profile would be each player having one vector or of probabilities, right, for all his or her actions, okay? Now, considering payoff, it is clear that while in these pure states, we would just only have to read what's written in one of those cells, in the case of randomization, we would have to compute an expectation, OK? Okay? And in this case, the random variable is the utility, and the probabilities are just the randomization or mixing probabilities of each player, right? And we will understand that formula on the next slide. What's important is that this each player's utility, right, or expected utility, is linear in those mixing probabilities. And it's even a convex function, which has its consequences later on, right? A pure strategy is nothing but a special mixed strategy, right? If I play something for sure and the other ones I will never play, this is also a special probability distribution. So these pure things are not anything new because they're just special forms of mixed strategies, right? Now, this is an example, right? If I have this matrix, what's the utility, right? So we'll assume that the first player randomizes as 1/3, 1/3, 1/3, and the second one randomizes as 0, 1/2, 1/2, right? So the first player's mixed strategy would be this, second player's mixed strategy would be this. And the utility of the first player, we would then have to have two probabilities times the utility value. Right? So it's always the product here of all the players' randomizations. So J goes from 1 to the number of players. So here the product of all randomization probabilities corresponding to the matrix entry in question times the utility of the respective player. So for example, here this 4 gets multiplied by this 1/3 and this 0, this 1/3 and this 0. So in essence, there's no contribution from this, right? And this 5 gets multiplied by this 1/3 and this 1/2, right? So the overall utility when playing this mixed strategy is 11/2, and the other one is 27/6. Now, this is just to see why this formula is as it is, right? Good. Now, let's take an example here. We have this nice matrix, and again, the question is, what shall we do? Let's analyze. Okay, good. Obviously, let's first investigate the blue player's options. So no matter what the brown or orange player does, playing R would give a strictly higher playoff than playing M. Yeah? Because 2 is larger than 1, 6 is larger than 4, 8 is larger than 6. Right? So M is strictly dominated by R. Okay? Now, player 1 knows that the second player will thus not play M because R dominates M, right? So M is kind of ruled out. Now, the only options that are left are L and R, right? So if L and R are the only options, and I regard my brown or orange utilities, what I see is that 4 is larger than 2 and 6 is larger than 3. 4 is also larger than 3 and 6 larger than 2. Right? Because M is ruled out. Okay? So, U is better than M or D. Now, the second player also knows player one's considerations, right? Because they all know that they know that they know that they know that they know, right? So, player two will know that player one will play U. Right? Because U strictly dominates M and D under the condition that M is not played. Right? So, knowing that the first player will play U, the only thing that is left is to choose, do I play L or do I play R? And that's easy because 3 is larger than 2, so player 2 will play L. Right? And that's a simple reasoning because the only thing that I do is in an iterated fashion, cross out or delete those strategies that are dominated, right? And then if I then arrive at a single cell, then this is a pure Nash equilibrium. So I know that in this game, UL is actually a pure Nash equilibrium, and it's clear what to do, right? If there are no others, okay? But if iterated strict dominance is successful, then I think, as far as I remember, this is the only Nash equilibrium in the game, right? Good. And you can ask yourself, well, doesn't that depend on the order? What? So here we started somehow with player two. Would that be different if I started with player one? Now, there is, if I start with player one, in this case, this would not actually work in that fashion. So I have to find a definite starting point. And once I find the starting point for this iterated strict dominance, the sequence doesn't matter. Right, so I will always, if it works, I will always end up in one spot. And the reason for that is if some strategy is strictly worse than another strategy in some possible set D, then S is also strictly worse compared to any subset of D. Okay, and that corresponds to the fact that the sequence does not matter. Right, so I can guarantee that I will always end up in the right spot if it works. So not every, it doesn't work for every game, which is the downside, right? If it works, it will work, yeah? Sure. For player one, you mean? No, for player two, you were right. For the blue one. Yeah, sorry. Confused you, yeah? Okay. So we can try. I mean, if we say right from the start, okay, if we started with the orange player, right, would we find a strategy that would dominate all the others, right? Well, I think that's not possible, right? Because if I can't rule out N, right, U is not a candidate because 8 is larger than 5, right? M is not a candidate because here U is better, and D is also not a candidate because here 3 and 6 are better, right? So neither U, M, or D does strictly dominate all the others if I don't rule out possibilities of the blue player, right? In this case, M. And so it only works if I start with the blue one. Good. So that's one way to find this. And we will see that there is a second way, but this will yield mixed Nash equilibria. And that's by exploiting the indifference rule, which we will see in a second. Right? Now, second example, right? Again, we're having two players, but now the second player only has two options. But this is nothing fundamentally different. So for the first player, what we see is that M is not dominated by U. Right? If you just compare, M is not dominated by D. Sorry. So not dominated by D and not dominated by U as well. Right? However, if the first player randomizes between U and D, he will get a guaranteed payoff of 1/2, regardless how the other player plays, right? So what we see is that a pure strategy can be dominated by a mixed strategy, even if the constituents do not strictly dominate that. So even if it's not strictly dominated by any pure strategy, right? So this shows you that very simple reasoning might fail in terms of the mixed strategies, right? So if you regard mixed strategies, things maybe become, well, not so easy in a sense, right? Good. Now let's consider some more notation, which we will require when we will try to define Nash equilibrium, right? Good. What we will do is we will discuss the strategy options for some player I, right? Whatever this player I is, and we will hold the other player's options fixed. When we do so, we will denote the other player's actions, so the strategy profile that is composed of all the things that the other players play, as S minus I. And so the whole strategy profile is always denoted as SI prime, for example. So what do I play as player I? And the stuff that the others play. But this is so a short notation for this longer version here. Right? Because the strategy profile always consists of large I many strategies. Right? But this is what we will usually denote. And the same is the notation for mixed strategies. Right? So a pure strategy is a single strategy, or in other words, a mixed strategy with probabilities that somehow look like this. Yeah? Or the one might also be at another place, right? But only this is a pure strategy, and a mixed strategy will have non-trivial probabilities in 0, 1, right? Now, a pure strategy, SI, is strictly dominated for player I if some strategy exists such that this some strategy gives a larger utility value than this dominated strategy. And that is the case no matter what the other players play. So that is for all other players' actions, possible actions, right? If this is the case, then we say that this sigma I prime strictly dominates this SI, this pure strategy. And the same notation goes for weak domination. And there we would just replace the larger sign by a larger or equal sign, and we would have a larger for at least one of the other players' configurations, right? If this is the case, we'll call this weak domination, and this is the definition for strict domination, okay? Now you might ask yourself, well, what's apparent here, right? So apparent is that, first of all, we only check for other players' pure alternatives, right? So where the cursor now is, and in all the other four spots, there is only an S minus I and not a sigma minus I. So we don't test for mixed strategy alternatives of the other players, because there'd be many more such an infinite amount of uncountable amount of possibilities in fact. Right? Now, the thing is, if this inequality holds for all pure alternatives, it also holds for all mixed alternatives. Why? Because this utility function here is a convex combination of the pure strategies, right? And what is a convex function? The definition of convex function is that. So if I take the function of a single argument, I define that if I regard the function compared to a straight line which joins these two points, then at each intermediate point here, which is given by this linear interpolation between x and y. So x is the argument's value, the first one, and y is the second one. And this is a linear interpolation. So all the points that lie in between here, x and y, if any function value at these points must be exactly smaller than any point on the straight line combining those two points or joining those two points, right? So the true function is always below the linear well, counterpart, if you like, right? And this is the explanation why we don't have to check for mixed alternatives in terms of the other players, because it only suffices to check for the cornerstones, because I know if the cornerstones fulfill the inequality, then anything that is a convex combination of those cornerstones does also automatically fulfill that, right? So this is nice because we won't have to check all the uncountable many mixed strategy alternatives of the other players. That's a nice thing here, right? Good. Okay, good. Now, let's leave it at that because there's already a lot of yawning going on, right? And tomorrow we're going to take this up, discuss a bit more game theory, and very probably we're not getting through with this, so I'll take the next Tuesday, but then we're done, right? And remember that today I will write an announcement for the games engineering students with respect to their final presentations on the 7th and 8th of July, right? So see you tomorrow.